Yes, of course. Michael Apted has been making the 7-Up series for the last half a century. He started on that project when he was 22 and he's now 72, still going strong. And, of course, we all look forward to the next installations of that series. I suppose the next one's, what, 63 up? They're getting to serious numbers. 70 will be a big party, no doubt. Well, we thought we'd continue that theme of people who are in it for the long haul with a discussion of people who are dealing with these sorts of long-term questions and projects in a range of different industries. Craig Alchin is an adjunct professor of architecture at the University of Technology in Sydney and director of the firm Six Degrees. As an urban planner, Craig works on plans that he won't see come to fruition for sometimes upwards of 30 years. David Harrich is an associate professor at the Queensland Institute of Medical Research, and he's been working on a cure for HIV since the early 1980s. Both Craig and David joined me in the studio earlier this week. David, if I can start with you, can you tell us about the project that you've been working on and how long you've been cutting away at it?
Well, for about the last 26 years, I've spent a lot of time studying HIV. The main thing that we do is we've been studying a specific protein of HIV called TAT, and I never intended for it to be a lifelong work, but it seems that it's taken this long to make a breakthrough with this protein, and it looks like, you know, with a lot of hard work and dedication that we may have something that's very effective at treating HIV.
And so when you began on that strain of work, David, did you have any sense of how long it was going to take you?
Absolutely not. No, I took the job originally back in 1986, so quite a while ago, and I was just a research assistant, and I looked at this as just an incredibly interesting project, and I really got very passionate about it and worked really hard and turned it into a PhD. And after my PhD, I thought, well, there's going to be an AIDS vaccine and probably have to study something else in the near future, but it just hasn't worked out that way. Mm.
Craig, you, I suppose, are in a slightly different category because in terms of urban planning work, you have a pretty fair idea when you begin a project that it's a very long-term project, something that could last for, you know, the rest of your life or even longer. I understand you've been involved in planning cities from scratch for China. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm an architect by training, but I sort of found myself in a company that was starting to do competitions for new cities in China, and we were contacted by email and said, come and join us for a competition. So we ended up delivering a competition entry for a new port city just off Shanghai. A few people said to me, there's already a city at Shanghai, but this was as they were expanding the container shipping. So we designed a city for 300,000 people, and then from that project got into a sort of long process of competitions and some commissions that look at. I think we did over 40 master plans in 4 years.
Is master planning the sort of process where you do the long-term thinking but then you step back from it and leave it to somebody else to implement? Or is it something that you're likely to be involved in for, you know, over those 30 or 40 years?
Oh, that'd be nice. I think in China, it's interesting. China was and still is under such enormous pressure to urbanise that they were sort of just throwing numbers out, throwing plans out for cities and just getting them started. So it's kind of like you're just trying to catch up. Sometimes you felt like they were building it before you'd finished the concept sketch. But I think these you've got to have a lot of hope to work on a city project where you think, you know, there's going to be a structure that you put in place and it's going to be there for 50 or 100 years. But I think one of the mistakes that we've often made is we think that it's an end state master plan. We think we can actually plan a city and it'll be like that. Mm. Whereas the more I do in this sort of area, the more I think we actually just need to put the sort of bones in place and let people make the city work for themselves. So I think it's good to have to do the thinking up front, but then you've got to sort of step back and let it go and sort of run the experiment and see what happens.
It's interesting that you talk about hope. David Harrich, how big a factor would you say hope has been in your professional vocation and the work on HIV?
Well, is it hope? I don't know if it's hope. I think it's more determination, you know? When you're working with HIV and you see the devastation around the world and you see that, you know, there's very good drugs out there now, but there's still no cure, that you have to maintain a certain passion and a determination that you're going to be able to make a difference with the research that you're conducting.
There must have been times for both of you that those long-term plans create immense moments of frustration. Is that something that you've both experienced?
Absolutely. I mean, well, in biomedical research, it's grant funding. So you're always under the gun that you have to have enough scientific discovery to convince your peers that your science is worth continued funding. And if not, then you're out of the game. And it happens to a lot of scientists.
Is the research funding system in some ways structured against genuine long-term projects? If you, you know, wrote on your submission, this will probably take 30 years, but it's very important, would you, would you get the money as easily?
I wish you would get 30 years. You get 3 years usually. Yeah. You get 3 years, and you're dealing with a system currently that has about a 20% award rate. So you have an 80% chance of failing going in.
Putting aside the Craig, you want to say something there?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think having worked on a number of China projects, I came back to Australia and worked on metropolitan strategies in Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide. And I think you're saying there's some frustrations. I think if you spend a lot of time thinking about plans for cities for the next 25 or 30 years and you start to actually imagine that's what's the time frame that you live in is actually this 20 or 30 year time frame. So things in that over that time seem very immediate. Mm. And so I find the frustration is if the first moves aren't made to start to implement the plan properly, you feel as if the whole thing's going off the rails already, yet it's only 1 or 2 years into a 30-year plan. So you've got to, I think, be careful not to think everybody's like you and they're all thinking about what it's going to be like in 30 years.
Perhaps one area of commonality from urban planning to research into HIV is the potential for societal attitudes and politics to be a major shaping factor at the very early stages of a project. David, can you tell us how the kind of cultural and political context of your work has changed? Because researching HIV in the early days was a very different proposition, wasn't it?
Well, there's a lot of drugs today that handle HIV infection quite effectively. So I think from a societal aspect, some of the anecdotal evidence that you hear is that people are less concerned about HIV in thinking that, well, if I get infected, I'll just take a pill, not realizing that once they're infected, they become immersed in the medical system. You know, they're seeing doctors and taking pills and having blood drawn and being followed probably for the rest of their life. So, you know, I don't think really people understand that. So we might be able to do a better job in public health in explaining to people that this is still a very serious situation. On a political side, I think, it's kind of interesting that around the world, there's a real push to come up with a cure for HIV or to come up with a cure for AIDS. But while it's supported in Australia, it is not one of the concentrated research areas. So it doesn't receive the recognition of, say, diabetes or heart disease or whatnot, that this is an important problem we're solving. And we're talking about, 34 million people infected worldwide. So I think that's one thing politically that should happen is that HIV should be given, more attention.
David, I was interested to know from you, when you started working in HIV, there was a lot of fear around the area. Did friends or colleagues think that it was, or say to you that it was not a good thing to be immersing yourself in?
I don't think it was that. I think people just became afraid to shake your hand. Right. As soon as they found out what you were doing. So they didn't know how it was transmitted. They didn't realize you had to be a lot closer than handshaking to get HIV. But they still look at you a little bit funny, but that sort of passed. You know, after I did it for the first 10 years, they realized, it's pretty safe, isn't it? When you're in a laboratory wearing all your gear and you know where the virus is at, you can protect yourself. So I think that's changed.
Have there been moments, because you're saying 26 years you've been working on this project, yes?
Absolutely.
Have there been moments where you've just thought, look, it's important work, but I need to move on or I want to try something different?
This is what you do when you're a scientist. You try to set up experiments to make your projects fail. We don't set up experiments to make the projects prove that they work. We set up strenuous hurdles to show they won't work, and then we stop working on it. And so, we had inklings all along. There was never evidence that what we were doing was wrong. So, I like to call it stirring the pot, because these kind of projects that we're working on, a cure for AIDS, Actually, they're kind of hard to fund because they're hit or miss. You know, they either work or they don't work. If they don't work, you're not going to get any more money. So usually what we do is some basic science, you know, where we try to learn not only about HIV, but also how human beings, you know, cell biology and whatnot. We mix the two. And with that money, we always have that back pot stirring a little bit. And so you keep this going. That's why I have PhD students. You know, PhD yeah. students do the projects that postdocs postdocs need salary. PhD students do not. So they work on these more difficult projects.
Craig Ulchin, David's spoken about the difficulties of the funding process and how you kind of structure your research to maximize that. I imagine when you're dealing with urban planning, there must be a kind of tension between the big picture idea that you want to achieve, but also the need to kind of sex that up a bit and sell it to the people who've got their hands around the purse strings today. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think there's so much competition to try and attract the small amounts of funding we have both federally and state levels to do the projects we need. So in the urban planning world, we think there's, you know, loads of things that need to be done, of course, over the next 50, 100 years. But I think there can be some frustrations as well as you were saying before, things change as the project goes along. So, you know, back in the 60s, everybody thought we needed just loads more freeways and the suburbs were going to go to it forever. And now people are starting to wind that back, and I think preferences are changing. A lot of people want to live where the action is. The next generation, I think, wants to live a much more urban life than suburban life. So we've got to, I think, start to enable the city to get a lot more capacity in the inner areas. So then you think, okay, well, what sort of transport system can help to serve that? If people are going to have not as many cars and we're going to live more densely, what should we be spending the money on? So there's this constant tension between governments announcing road projects or more public transport projects or trying to create more land on the fringe or the existing area. So it's, I think you've got to be pretty nimble and try and keep across the debate as it goes, but with, again, at the same time, you've got to have the long-term vision and say, well, it's going to be a sustainable city and a livable city and an equitable city, so how do those things measure up against the big aims? I think it's really important to have a long-term aim and a set of solid principles. Often when you read a vision statement in a planning document, it all seems pretty dull and generic, but it's actually important to have a bit of a solid vision and some solid principles against which you can measure all these things. Otherwise, it's very unscientific and you can, you know, you're not going to get guided by those big ideas.
David Harich, in the time that you've been working on your research, are there moments where you feel like you're very close to cracking something that you might be able to draw a line under the research and because there's something brewing?
Well, I can, from my own experience, it's dreadfully slow. It's so slow that you don't even know you're making progress at some times, you know? So, you know, you look for those eureka moments, you know, and they don't happen that often. You know, I would say in 26 years, there's probably been about four of them.
Wow.
And each one has actually led to the current point I'm at now. It's not like I was looking for this. See, that's the thing about when you're doing scientific discovery, you're trying to find something that is true. So you have things that are true or they are false or not true. And if it really is true, then the experiments work and you make progress. You know, if you're clever enough to figure out all the clues that the experiments are giving you. So I would say, yeah, you know, you have them. I mean, you know, we've been very fortunate, I think, over the last, say, 3 years that we've actually experienced two.
Well, that's what I was going to say. How are they distributed? I mean, it's a long time between drinks, but when was the most recent drink and how did it taste?
Well, God, really good. I mean, the lab is just cooking right now. I think we have a couple of really great projects and the whole group is energized. Yeah, so we're cooking on all four burners now.
Craig Ulchin, I suppose in you know, whether you're planning redesigns of cities or cities from scratch, there's not a QED moment where you go, okay, well, that's done, we can move on. But what are some of the ups and downs in that process of trying to shape a long-term vision but also, you know, make it appealing to people in the present day?
I think there's been a big shift in the last 20 or 30 years probably away from the sort of end state high modernism that we were seeing in the 60s, which led to such sort of disastrous parts of cities, the Caboosian Tower in the park and so on. And now we've gone all the way to kind of community consultation and we're almost trying to divine from the community what we should be doing with our cities. In a lot of people's view, it's all about that. It's gone to the other end of the spectrum. I think it's we need to be sort of somewhere in the middle with a bit of strategy, but also with engagement in the community. So I think when you get a good set of information around which you can start to formulate some ideas, and then the community validates that, I think that's really an enjoyable moment. But working on big metropolitan strategies, one of them, you know, they only come out every 4 or 5 years or something. So I think you've kind of got to fix yourself around creating a story that people can understand and actually believe in, I think. So to me, almost the bigger the ambition in urban planning, in the longer the time frame, the shorter the sort of elevator pitch needs to be. You need to have a good story that can try and wrap up a lot of it, instead of just saying, well, high rise is bad, low rise is good. We need to say, well, you know, a high rise city is going to be more sustainable. But I think more and more we need a good story that people can believe in, that then that might be the thing that lasts for the 20 or 30 years as a vision.
Craig, have you got a date set in your diary 10 years or so down the track where you might be able to go and visit your city?
I'd love to. In the first competition we did in Shanghai, we actually lost, sadly, to some a German team, and they planned a sort of a circular lake, which the mayor at the time liked the symbolism of a drop of water and a circular sort of rings of coming from the droplet. So they planned that, and I flew over it a few years ago, and the lake's there, but there's actually no town around it, because I think our strategy was to actually make a real structure and a real town, but it's one of China's problems is the mayor really liked the kind of circle idea, so he went with the circle. So I'll stick with the idea. Our town would have been full, but, you know, we didn't win, so.
Right, interesting. And David, what about you? Do you expect that you will, during your working lifetime, see the end of the project that you're working on and a cure for HIV?
I think so. I think it's still going to be a few years down the road, but if it's not us, it's going to be a number or another lab in Europe or America. There's going to be a breakthrough clinical trial that's going to show that there's an effective therapy for AIDS. So, yeah, I'm going to see it in my lifetime for sure.
And have you got another kind of 30, 40-year plan to fall back on when that day comes?
Let's see. When can I retire? No, I'll be in business another 17 years.
Excellent.
I plan on being in business another 17 years.
Well, the clock is ticking on all of us, and unfortunately we'll have to leave it there. But Craig Alchin and David Harich, thanks so much for joining us on Friday Drive.
Thanks, Julian.
Two men there and their lifelong missions as it approaches it's just past 7:25. So we're 3/4 of the way through the long haul that is Friday Drive on RN. Julian Morrow with you. And we are now about to really expand the range of what counts as a lifelong mission, because we're going to be speaking to somebody who's preparing for a mission that stretches well beyond her lifetime, although she is an optimist about it. Dr. Mae Jemison was the first African-American female astronaut. She flew a space mission with NASA in 1992. Now she heads up the 100-year Project Starship. Their mission, and they've chosen to accept it, is to take a ship and crew beyond the solar system by, and now how's this for a deadline, by the year 2112.
So the 100-year Starship is an initiative to make sure that the capabilities of human travel to another star system exist within the next 100 years. So two things I want to point out. One is capabilities, not that we're launching a mission, but we want to make sure all those capabilities exist. And secondly, it doesn't have to be 100 years. If we do it sooner, then maybe I can go.
Well, I suppose that's a very strong incentive, isn't it?
Yes, it's the whole idea is of this was how to really incentivize the kind of explosive innovation in technology and science, I think also in creativity, that we saw attendant with the 1960s and, you know, the human push to go to the moon. Mm. A lot of people call it the space race or the moon race or whatever. But as a little girl growing up, I really saw it just as human creativity and this incredible zest that we have.
Can you give us a sense of the scale of the project? I mean, we talked about going to the moon. Compared to the power and resources and technology required to do that, what is needed to pull off the project that you're leading?
If you go to another star, let me just put going to another star in context. The closest star to us is about 4.2 light years away, which is like 25 trillion miles, okay? The furthest that human-made object has gone from us is somewhere around 8 billion miles or more. And that was Voyager 1 that was launched in 1977, and it's been going about somewhere around 35,000 miles per hour since then. And so that's a very short distance. If we were to go at that same speed, it would take us 70,000 years to get to another star. So there are a couple of things that's really difficult, right?
Yeah.
So you have to find a completely different energy source in order to go much faster. And we also have to learn a lot about how to take care of ourselves and sustainability, those kinds of issues. Because just think about it. You have to carry everything you need with you. The likelihood that you're going to turn right around or have supplies or things like that are very nil.
Not a trip to be forgetting your umbrella or whatever you need.
Yeah. So you have to figure out, you know, whether it's food, it's clothing, energy systems. We're going to have to figure out a lot about recycling and also about human behavior, because just imagine that you'd get 1,000 people, 1,500 people in a world ship. Does governance break down? What happens when you get further and further away from the law? What is the biggest stumbling block we have today is our behavior towards one another, right?
Wow. God, if you think our behavior is the challenge compared to all those other things, then our behavior must be a real issue. But
it has been the issue. It really is the issue in many ways. The human equation is but very much the part that makes us able to do these kinds of things and sometimes the part that holds us back.
Dr. Mae Jemison, you've already achieved some amazing things that I think, you know, an ordinary person would consider an incredible life goal, even just traveling into space yourself. How did you react when the idea of taking on a project with this massive lead time and dealing with unprecedented challenges was first pitched to you?
When I first heard about, you know, how do we send humans to another star system? How do we put together a project that can galvanize the public to do this? You know what my thought was? It was, I know how to do this. I can do this. And the reason I thought that is because this is really something that's transdisciplinary. When I think about space exploration, I know that it's something that is very much a part of us as humans. There's an African proverb that says, no one shows a child the sky. This is part of us, right? Mm. We get to choose and create what we want to do. Every group of people around the world have always looked up at the stars and wondered what they were. Some of us have wanted to go, but it's always been a part of our lives. And so I think this is really one of those extensions. When I thought about the project, I recognized that there are some things that have to happen. We have to, first of all, recognize that this is one of those things that we might call a grand challenge. Right? Mm. It's something that's very difficult, but it's compelling, but it can have a lasting impact across so many fields. If you think of grand challenges as things like getting rid of smallpox or circumnavigating the globe, those are grand challenges that changed our world continuously. Landing on the moon, we now look at ourselves very, very differently. Mm. Yet each one of them were so compelling that people could rally around them.
It's obviously intoxicating, your excitement for the project and your optimism that maybe it can be achieved in less than 100 years. But are there ever moments that are kind of tinged by sadness or regret that this exciting goal might not be achieved during your stewardship of it or even your lifetime?
I think that we all take on those kinds of projects or programs or ideas just by being born, whether it's as parents who we have children who will probably live beyond our lifetime, or whether it's starting a company, or whether it's being part of a nation, our society, those things live beyond us. And so what we have to do is choose how we want to contribute. And my idea is that if we start pursuing an extraordinary tomorrow, that we start to create a better world today, because each time we make choices about what do we do with our funds, do we train our children, for a better tomorrow, do we look at how we preserve our resources, do we sort of put goodwill into the world rather than things that are sort of spiteful and very short living. Those are the kind of choices we get to make. And so when we talk about, is this possible, I always like to think about this whole idea of suspending disbelief. We have to think, perhaps these things can be done. If you think about it, years ago, people didn't believe humans could fly, right? But actually, people had to just suspend disbelief long enough to figure out how to do it. And that's what we're doing now. We're saying, if we suspend disbelief, just for a little while, we can figure out how to do this.
Well, I think I can honestly say I've never spoken to somebody who is shooting for the stars in a more literal sense than you, Dr. Mae Jemison. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.